Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, second chapter, fifth verse, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Chirani kim patina sandida shanti viksham.
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 Naivam kripa paravrita saritopya susham.
Naivam kripa
paravrita saritopya susham.
Naivam kripa paravrita saritopya susham.
Ruddha kuhakam ajito vati no pasanam.
Ruddha kuhakam ajito vati no pasanam.
Kimajito vati no pasanam.
Ruddha kuha kimajito vati no pasanam.
Tasma pujanti kavayo dana jorma dhandhan.
Tasma pujanti kavayo dana jorma dhandhan.
Chirani kimvati na sandhiri santi viksham.
Chirani kimvati na sandhiri santi viksham.
Naivam gripa vrita saritopya susham.
Naivam gripa vrita saritopya susham.
Ruddha guha kim ajito vati no pasanam.
Ruddha guha kim ajito vati no pasanam.
Tasma bhajanti gavayo dana durma dandhan.
Tasma bhajanti gavayo.
Give him realized direction towards self-realization. Among the other duties in the renounced order of life of Srila Sanatana, Srila Rupa, and the other Goswamis of Vrindavan, the foremost duty discharged by them was to hold learned discourses amongst themselves at Seva Kunja, Vrindavan, the spot where Sri Radha Damodar Temple was established by Srila Jiva Goswami, and where the actual samadhi tombs of Srila Rupa Goswami and Srila Jiva Goswami are laid. For the benefit of all human society, they left behind them immense literatures of transcendental importance. Similarly, all the acharyas who voluntarily accepted the renounced order of life aimed at benefiting human society and not at living a comfortable or irresponsible life at the cost of others. Read that again. Similarly, all the acharyas who voluntarily accepted the renounced order of life aimed at benefiting human society and not at living a comfortable or irresponsible life at the cost of others. However, those who cannot give any contribution should not go to the householders for food, for such mendicants asking bread for the householders from the householders are an insult to the highest order. Shukadeva Goswami gave this warning especially for those mendicants who adopt this line of profession to solve their economic problems. Such mendicants are in abundance in the age of Kali. When a man becomes a mendicant willfully or by circumstances, he must be of firm faith and conviction that the Supreme Lord is the maintainer of all living beings everywhere in the universe. Why then would he neglect the maintenance of a surrendered soul who is 100% engaged in the service of the Lord? A common master looks to the necessity of his servant, so how much more would the all-powerful, all-opulent Supreme Lord look after the necessities of life for a fully surrendered soul? The general rule is that a mendicant devotee will accept a simple, small loincloth without asking anyone to give it in charity. He simply salvages it from the rejected torn cloth thrown in the street. When he is hungry, he may go to a magnanimous tree which drops fruits. And when he is thirsty, he may drink water from a flowing river. He does not require to live in a comfortable house, but should find a cave in the hills, and not be afraid of jungle animals, keeping faith in God, who lives in everyone's heart. The Lord may dictate to tigers and other jungle animals not to disturb his devotee. Haridas Thakur, a great devotee of Lord Sri Chaitanya, used to live in such a cave, and by chance a great venomous snake was a co-partner of the cave. Some admirer of Haridas Thakur, who had to visit the Thakur every day, feared the snake and suggested that the Thakur leave that place. Because his devotees were afraid of the snake and they were regularly visiting the cave, Thakur Haridas agreed to the proposal on their account. But as soon as this was settled, the snake actually crawled out of its hole in the cave and left the cave for good before everyone present. By the dictation of the Lord, who lived also within the heart of the snake gave preference to Haridas and decided to leave the place and not disturb him. So this is a tangible example of how the Lord gives protection to a bona fide devotee like Thakur Haridas. According to the regulations of Sanatana Dharma, of the Sanatana Dharma Institution, one is trained from the beginning to depend fully on the protection of the Lord in all circumstances. The path of renunciation is recommended for acceptance by one who is fully accomplished and fully purified in his existence. This stage is described also in Bhagavad Gita 16.5 as Daiti Sampat. A human being is required to accumulate Daiti Sampat, or spiritual assets. Otherwise, the next alternative, Asuri Sampat, or material assets, will overcome him disproportionately. And thus one will be forced into the entanglement of different miseries of the material world. A sannyasi should always live alone without company, and he must be fearless. He should never be afraid of living alone, although he is never alone. The Lord is residing in everyone's heart, and unless one is purified by the prescribed process, one will feel that he is alone. But a man in the renounced order of life must be purified by the process. Thus he will feel the presence of the Lord everywhere and will have nothing to fear, such as being without any company. Everyone can become a fearless and honest person if his very existence is purified by discharging the prescribed duty for each and every order of life. One can become fixed in one's prescribed duty by faithful oral reception of Vedic instructions and assimilation of the essence of Vedic knowledge by devotional service to the Lord. Om Aginati Nandasya Gananjana Salakaya Shakthuranitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamayam Dharati Svatlantikam. I was traveling once in India on the train, and it sometimes happens I pulled into a station and stopped for a long time. Usually the stops are only for 3 or 4 or 5, 10 minutes, but this was a half hour or more affair. And right opposite where I was sitting on the platform were two men. One was maybe in his 60s and the other looked to be in mid to late 20s. Both were mendicants. They had been sleeping on that train platform. It was about maybe 7 or 8 in the morning. So they were having a discussion. It was right outside the window where I sat, so I couldn't ignore it. It was the only really thing to see if one was awake. And so they had some books, and they were kind of reading and to each other. And then we got up, and the older man just had a like a kind of a loincloth and a single chadar, very thin cloth, and a stick, and all of his possessions, which were a few books and a tilak and a few other things, he kind of wrapped up in a stick, wrapped up in the cloth and put on the stick and put it over his shoulder and walked away. Then the younger person, who had a beard and black hair, kind of did the same thing, just wrapped a few things up, put them on his straw that he had, and before the elder person left, he kind of bid his friend goodbye, and they seemed very happy and walked away. Then the other person got up and put his things together, and in just one or two pieces of cloth, got up and walked away, and they both seemed very satisfied and very happy. And I was thinking to myself, what a nice existence, just sleep on a train platform and have a few possessions, put them together in a cloth, get up and walk away, and very happy. What a simple kind of mendicant sort of life one could lead, especially there. And obviously they weren't starving to death. The elderly person was a little portly. I mean, he didn't look like he was starving. And just kind of go from place to place and beg a little, live that way, and depend on God. So this, of course, is a very wonderful and famous verse that is a case for renunciation. Of course, in Kali Yuga and in the Western countries, it's not so easy. Renunciation is not looked upon very favorably. People who give up the world are considered to be pretty out of it, or crazy. But when Vedic culture was flourishing, there were many mendicants, and still in India, see many of them, living in a very simple way, and depending on the mercy of the Lord for all their necessities of life, their cloth, their food, their shelter, the caves, the trees, for food, and so on. And Prabhupada is warning here that one shouldn't flatter people to gain a good subsistence, especially wealthy people, and become a parasite. And he defines parasite very nicely here. That a parasite is someone who lives off society and doesn't give anything back to society to get worldly admiration. Very interesting. And there are many parasites. According to the dictionary, it says a parasite is a sycophant who lives at the cost of society without making any contribution. Many people come from so-called developing countries to the West, and they're especially, we notice that when people come from India, they're usually coming to gain some wealth or some education or better position. And Prabhupada used to say that his reason for coming was not to take but to give, because India has so many wonderful things to give, such a wealth of spiritual knowledge, such a great culture, and that this should be given rather than someone coming to the West to take. So sometimes he was very critical about the people of his land. I heard a news conference once in which he was being questioned about why did he go to the West? Was he just trying to get followers and money? And a lot of people there think that Krishna consciousness is successful because there's a lot of Western influence, money, and resources involved. So Prabhupada was very heavy. He said, you are forgetting your culture, therefore this land, this India, has become the greatest offender. Very heavy statement. On the other hand, it is a very auspicious position to be born in that land where there's so many holy rivers and holy cones and holy places of pilgrimage. It actually is a great benediction, and there's a great deal to give. In one class, however, Prabhupada said that India was a breeding ground for gods, that there are so many people walking the streets as God, and they have come to the West sometimes as great yogis or great personalities, and people worship them as God. So Prabhupada called this, of course, the society of cheaters and the cheated. Everyone wants
someone to follow, and everyone is looking for God. So if a person can make a nice presentation, then I am God, the tendency is to, for those who want to be cheated, to follow. And here the case is being made for renunciation, that actually one can live very simply and depend upon the mercy of God. When we put this in modern context, although it was very nice to see how people were able to live very simply and be dependent on God and just have a few possessions, the same sense of renunciation is achieved in this context of the modern world when one is not attached to one's surroundings, when one doesn't flatter the wealthy, when one becomes active in Krishna consciousness and through devotional service becomes very advanced in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada says in the last paragraph, one can become fixed in one's prescribed duty by faithful oral reception of Vedic instructions and assimilation of the essence of Vedic knowledge by devotional service to the Lord. So the essence of Vedic knowledge isn't to become artificially renounced, to give everything up and to live a very simple life, which of course is not possible in this day and age, in this time, in this place, but to engage in devotional service to the Lord. And this, he says, is the way that one can assimilate the essence of Vedic knowledge. The one who is intelligent will try to find the essence, the essential teaching. The Vedas are very bewildering, and India is a very bewildering experience, and the numbers of so-called holy people, they are very bewildering. The whole thing is very confusing to a seeker. In the beginning, it is very confusing. And there are many who are proclaiming to be the one, or the absolute knowledge. It's like it said, if you go to many 10 doctors, you'll get 11 different opinions. So there are so many so-called experts in the field of spiritual knowledge, and they all have different opinions. And so it's a very bewildering, unclear array, and very hard to get the essence of spiritual knowledge. Therefore, it's very important for all of us to hear regularly the Srimad Bhagavatam. Not only the Srimad Bhagavatam, but Prabhupada's purports, because in these purports, he's explaining how one can adopt the principles of the Bhagavatam and apply them in our current situation. It's not just the Bhagavatam philosophy, not just Jnana, but Vijnana. So Prabhupada will write a very long purport, 2 pages long in this case, to explain the meaning of renunciation. A real renunciation, according to Rupa Goswami, is anashaktasya vishayam yataram upayunjita nirbandha krishna sambandhe devairagya uchite. One has to learn the art of engaging everything in Krishna's service. That's real renunciation. Upanji kataya budya hari sambandha vatsanai mukshivi parityago vairagya bhava katite. And one who doesn't understand this principle, it is said, is incomplete renunciation. So real renunciation for this day and age is incomplete unless one knows how to engage everything that is connected with Krishna in Krishna's service. That's also the message of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna wasn't ordered to go and just live off the fruit falling from the trees or in the caves, or to just dress with torn clothing. He was a kshatriya. He had royal clothing. He lived in a palace. He ate very sumptuously. But he was the most renounced because he followed what Krishna wanted him to do. He had to act. He had to be acting in a way that he didn't even want to act. But he wasn't the renunciant. He was a kshatriya. And according to what Krishna wanted him to do, he would become purified. If he acted under Krishna's direction, he would be the perfect renouncer. So it's explained in Bhagavad Gita that real sannyas is acting for Krishna. That's what we mean by renunciation. Renunciation doesn't mean what most people think it means, not to do anything, or not to talk, or not to hear, or not to make eye contact with anybody. But real renunciation is to do Krishna's bidding, what Krishna actually wants us to do. That's renunciation. And that, of course, is achieved through what Prabhupada says is devotional service to the Lord. There's so many activities that we can do And if we're engaged in those activities fully, we actually forget, one forgets what one's personal desires are. And eventually, one understands that one's ultimate personal desires are non-different from what Krishna desires, because we all want to be happy. We all want to be doing what we like to do. And there's nothing that we can like to do better than to have a perfect relationship with Krishna and to act on his behalf. That's actually what everyone wants, but they just don't know. There's something separating them from real happiness. And the duty of devotees is to remove that obstacle or those obstacles and to help people see what they're really after. So as Lord Chaitanya told us, Chaitanya Dharma Marjana, this is a process for cleansing the heart and for bringing people the nectar which they're always after, but don't know it. So one man was asking last night, why are we here? And Prabhupada was asked a similar question once. What's the purpose of life? So these seem like kind of bewildering questions. You know, why are we here? What's the purpose of life? And Prabhupada's simple answer to that was to enjoy. That's why we're here. We want to enjoy. What's the purpose of life? We want to be happy. We want to enjoy life. But we're just trying to do this in the wrong way, in the wrong place. We're focusing on the wrong things. We're trying to get our enjoyment from that which will not actually satisfy us. So Krishna and his followers, his dedicated rishis and munis and acharyas, and spiritual masters, gurus, and pure devotees of all description in all situations, they come to establish what real enjoyment is and how it can be attained, how it's not external, but it's within. So Krishna says that he's very pleased with someone whose happiness is within, who rejoices within. But that person is the real mystic, not the one who artificially renounces everything. I thought that this is kind of a long purport, very, in a sense, kind of hard to comment on because Prabhupada sort of says it all. But I thought I would just read something, if I may, about the guru, because it is through the spiritual masters that we come to Krishna consciousness. And in Mayapur, there was a long discussion about the position of the gurus in ISKCON and what the relationship between the Shiksha and the Diksha Guru is. So it's about a page and a half long. I thought I would, with your permission, read what one of the conclusions was and how we can better understand what the relationship is between Shiksha and Diksha Guru. Of course, we read in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, the first in the Adi Leela, 35th and 36th verses about the similarity between all the different gurus. But this is a question which it involves a lot of discussion, a lot of deep understanding, and there's one devotee named Shiva Maharaj wrote a whole book about it. It's about 300 pages long. It's very interesting. Now, he didn't write it alone, but he did it in consultation with a few other Vaishnavas who are known for their penetrating intellect and discussions of the Siddhanta, the Vaishnava philosophy, as Prabhupada has given it to us. So this is called, it's a resolution. Called Establishing Siksha Principles. And this is a statement that the governing body accepted. It begins, whereas defining the principles and standards of etiquette within these relationships will enable all members of ISKCON to better understand and appreciate each other and guru-disciple relationship, and respect should be offered to all devotees who act as our Siksha guides. GVC accepts the following statement of principles. Founder Acharya. So it's divided really into three main parts. The Founder Acharya, the Prabhupada, the Siksha Guru, and the Diksha Guru. The Founder Acharya. ISKCON's Founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada, is the preeminent and compulsory Siksha Guru for all Vaishnavas, gurus, and disciples in the society who may directly receive empowerment from him through allegiance to his teachings. Because of his position, is that personality empowered by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to fulfill his divine prophecy that Krishna consciousness be spread throughout the world. Srila Prabhupada is given unique and exceptional worship and respect by his direct followers as well as all subsequent followers. Members of ISKCON should understand Srila Prabhupada's teachings and be faithful to them. Lessons from all others, even our exalted predecessor acharyas, should be understood through his instructions. According to Srila Prabhupada, Lord Krishna takes responsibility for living sincere souls through his representatives. By adhering to Srila Prabhupada's instructions, even the non-liberated guru acts as one liberated, although he must constantly be aware of his position relative to the liberated guru and conduct himself accordingly, being attentive to avoid accepting any inappropriate mode of worship. The disciples who follow such a careful follower of Srila Prabhupada can achieve liberation. So that's a description of Prabhupada. Then we come to the Shiksha Guru. The basic definition of Guru is anyone who gives spiritual instructions based on the revealed scriptures. The acceptance of such instructions from the spiritual master is called Shiksha. And consequently, one who transmits transcendental knowledge to another is known as a Shiksha Guru. By taking responsibility for different aspects of Shiksha, Vaishnavas are known according to their specific dealings. The devotee who first gives Shiksha is the Bhagavan Pradarshika Guru, and the saints who give general instruction in devotional practice are known as sadhus or Shiksha Gurus. The Shiksha Guru who gives initiation with the holy name and Gayatri Mantra becomes known as the Diksha Guru, and those Vaishnavas who elevate one to transcendence by their teachings are also Shiksha Guru. I'll read that again because my inflection was a little off. The Shiksha Guru who gives initiation with the holy name and Gayatri Mantra becomes known as the Diksha Guru. And those Vaishnavas who elevate one to transcendence by their teachings are also Shiksha Guru. Any Vaishnava who gives instruction, shelter, and inspiration should be considered as Shiksha Guru. Because the transcendental knowledge which originates from Sri Krishna comes to a devotee through his Shiksha Guru, he deeply reveres them as confidential servants of Krishna and worships them according to their station. Then the Diksha Guru. Among many Shiksha Gurus, the one who, through personal association and regular instruction, inspires faith in a devotee, generally becomes the Diksha Guru. It is Lord Krishna's system that a conditioned soul must surrender to and take initiation from his representative, a guru in parampara. Although their dealings are different, both the Shiksha and Diksha Gurus are representatives of Lord Krishna and Srila Prabhupada, acting to guide the disciple back to Godhead. The disciple should not see them as superior or inferior on the basis of the difference in their dealings. The duty of a Diksha Guru is to train the disciple in the process of devotional service and initiate him by giving the holy name and Gayatri mantras. After initiation, further instructs the disciple in the meaning of the Vedas and remains committed to his liberation from repeated birth and death. In this time, the Diksha Guru is happy to see a disciple receiving training and guidance from many other Shiksha Gurus. For this is the opulence of the society. He may also recommend a disciple to a Shiksha Guru or Shiksha Gurus for specific tutoring for which some reason he is not able to give. There's some other aspects of this, some other parts of this resolution that talk about the relationship between the Shiksha and Diksha. Exceptions to protocol, qualifications of Guru, instructions from the Shiksha Guru, keeping faith in one's Guru, the GBC and suitability of Shiksha and the worship of Gurus, but I think we'll save this for another time because I've had as little today. So are there any comments or questions on it? What I've read or the verse or this? John, as a Prabhu.
You were discussing when I said Yukta Varagya. How can we, in practical terms, of course, the position of the Guru is important, but how in practical terms can we avoid taking advantage of that sometimes, you see? Because what is Yukta Varagya in terms of practical application for one may not be for another, according to one's station in life, according to one's maturity in spiritual life, etc., etc. And sometimes we try to imitate others who are, maybe that is for them, like Arjuna, as you say, was living a very opulent life and so on and so forth. And how can we avoid imitating that sometimes we see people in leadership roles who have very well situated devotee situations. Others may either create envy or pride or something like this. How can we avoid this in our society?
Some people can sit and read all day and be brahminical and really enjoy that, and they might even read some other books of philosophy and be able to apply it very nicely. Whereas someone else, you know, it's a very big effort to sit and read for an hour and wouldn't want to hear about any other philosophy, but might want to learn something about how to produce videotape or an audio tape, and that would be a form of Yukta Vairagya, to read how that body of knowledge can be Krishnaized so that that person could make those tapes. And the other person might, just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he read so much philosophy that was like existentialist, like Descartes, and read about Christian philosophy. And he spiritualized it. He was able to write very profuse, he wrote many, many books, dozens and dozens of books in his lifetime. And he used his study of various other philosophies of the world in presenting Vedic philosophy in a way that people could assimilate it. But he was a great scholar, and maybe someone else who's not such a great scholar. And everyone, according to Bhagavad Gita, Chaturvarna Mayashishaya is born with different types of propensities, different gunas, different qualities, and different activities that are natural to that person. So, what's, of course, poison to one person is nectar to another, what is honey to one person is death to another. Everybody is different. And the way in which we use the knowledge of this world is that each person uses a different aspect of it a little differently, because we're all different. Someone may study construction in order to build a temple. Someone else may study the art of sewing, or there's many books written about that, so they can learn how to nicely dress the deity. So another person might look at cookbooks that are Hare Krishna cookbooks, just to learn the art. And this is practiced sometimes so that we can engage in the service of Krishna. So Prabhupada's teaching was that this was possible. Before Prabhupada, most sadhus were living the kind of life we were reading about. They were very giving up everything and living a very simple life. And Prabhupada came to teach us that he said, if you're a businessman, do business for Krishna. If you're a singer, sing for Krishna. If you're good at doing some art, then paint for Krishna. If you sculpt, then sculpt for Krishna. So depending on what we're good at doing or what we like to do, and we may not know, we may have to ask, we may take many years to find out, but each person was given a different kind of, according to their nature, a different kind of activity to do. One person was doing this, another person was doing that, according to their propensities. So according to our abilities and our propensities, we act and we engage material energy in the service of Krishna. Of course, it is described in the Bhagavad Gita that there are different types of work. There's work that is capricious, there's laziness, and there is prescribed work. And of those three, we are into prescribed work. That is the work that's in devotional service. We're not into, and we shouldn't be into, just lazing around not doing anything. We shouldn't be into gratifying our senses. That's generating bad karma, vikarma. But we should be able to execute prescribed duties. And among the prescribed duties that we are executing, according to what Prabhupada writes in Bhagavad Gita, there is routine work, there's desire work, and there's emergency work. And sometimes we have to do all of them. And there's always kind of some emergencies that have to be seen to. There's routine work that always has to be seen to. We have to maintain ourselves, our temple. And then there's desire work, which is more along the line of what our natural propensities are. So those, all three things are there. And in all of those, we engage the service that's so-called material in the service of the Lord, then it becomes spiritualized. And Prabhupada compares it to putting an iron into a fire. It's an iron, it's made out of material elements, ferrous or whatever iron is. It's put in fire, and then when it becomes red hot, It has the qualities of fire, it acts like fire. So unless we can purify material energy like that, it isn't really yukta vairagya. And then the pitfall is that one can think, well, I'm a musician, so I'll sing rock songs for Krishna, and then he gets involved in the rock music scene, and then develops bad habits. So it's kind of a razor's edge in a sense, that yukta vairagya, engaging the material energy in the spirit, in the service of Krishna, in devotional service, one can be swallowed up by material energy and maya. But the process is to harness these material energy and to engage it in Krishna service. And how do we avoid the pitfall? We consult. We consult with Shiksha Guru, we consult with Diksha Guru, we consult the Shastras. And we're very careful to know that we're engaged in prescribed duty, and duty that is what Krishna wants us to do, not what we think we might want to do because we like it. So, our austerity is kind of like the austerity of Arjuna. It would be an austerity to renounce the kingdom, to go live in a cave like he wanted to do and give up the fight. But a greater austerity was to do what he really didn't want to do. And to not do what we want to do is also an austerity. But those are not felt to be difficult or austere if we're doing them under direction, if we're careful to act under the direction of Krishna and his representatives. So, yeah, it's kind of a two-edged thing, it's yukta vairagya. There's preaching is, that Prabhupada says, is not only a thankless task, but we also know that it's very dangerous because we have to mix with the material energy. So for us to read regularly and chant regularly and dissociate and eat only prasadam and try to spread Krishna consciousness is very, very important. Otherwise we can very easily get swallowed up in the material energy. Someone was asking Prabhupada in Los Angeles in 1968 about Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, how they seem to have fall down sometimes. So Prabhupada said, we have to learn. The lesson is that material energy is very, very powerful. We shouldn't succumb to it. Anyway, that's just some thoughts on it. Maybe you want to add some thoughts, some more.
Big subject. It's a very big subject.
Very big subject. Sashi.
Maharaj, with regard to yukta vairagya again, like you said, in the process of trying to use energy in Krishna service, sometimes we get enamored by the process itself and get caught up in it. There are two things. One is about sometimes we feel in our heart, we can feel that what we're doing is not exactly right. You know, sometimes intelligence or Chaitanya Guru within us tells us that not exactly yukta vairagya that we're performing this time. But when you go and try to take instructions with sadhus, guru and shastra, I mean shastra of course may corroborate what we feel, but sadhu and guru may not. In such situations, how much weightage should be given to what your conscience is saying and what the shastra is saying? Shastra in this context and within this call, I mean Prabhupada's books.
Yeah. But even Prabhupada's books, as explicit as they are with their purports, are not the be-all and end-all, because Prabhupada, of course, gives absolute shiksha, but it is a three-part check and balance system of guru, shastra, and sadhu. And even though Prabhupada is shiksha and he is personally there, he is not sitting here talking to him. We can't sort of interact with him, and we often don't get the experience that we can get by talking with other devotees who are our peers or even our juniors. We can learn from them immensely because they're, you know, up right up to speed, with up to date with what we're doing. This is, you know, 1999 and this is our situation. So according to Deshakala and Patra, they're acting. So we have to be very careful that we don't become too one-sided and just say, well, it says here, Prabhupada said this, therefore this is right. And then what you are saying, sadhu, or what you're saying, guru, that is wrong. Because actually, they're united. But sometimes we see that they're separate. But we have to go very deep into the matter and try to get the Siddhanta by through this system of Guru Shastra and Sattva, we have to find that the areas where they're in agreement and not the areas where they appear to be different. And of course there are some differences, but overall we're acting under the guidance of Krishna, and his representatives as gurus and sadhus are in line with what he is saying, and they're in line with what Prabhupada is saying. So we have to penetrate very deeply, and we have to be very careful about what we think Chaitra Guru is saying to us, or what even Chaitra Guru is saying to us, because the Chaitra Guru, as the Paramatma, is giving the thief intelligence how to steal, just like he's giving the householder the intelligence how to catch the thief. So it's not that whatever we're getting, is the right thing, is the spiritual thing, because Krishna's giving us a lot of independence. So we also have to rely upon the Shastra and the various other gurus to get the complete picture. Because if we rely too much on what we think, then we can find something in Prabhupada's books to back about just about anything on, and that happens. So we have to be careful and be intellectually honest and not lazy, and be very alert to the whole picture, and not just sort of act according to what we think is right and find something to back it up. We have to see the whole thing and try to understand the larger picture. Not be too selective. Yes?
Okay. Maharaj, on the topic of the Shikshi Guru, we look at all devotees as our Shikshi Guru, really. We can get instruction from anyone. But it's been a bit of a fashion for devotees to ask a particular guru, will you be my Shikshi Guru? Mm.
It's possible. It's not. It's not forbidden to do this. To have a particular faith in a particular. A stronger faith in one individual as a Shiksha Guru, but to become absolute and certified and official is. One has to be very careful, and I think it's, I'll read a little bit further in this resolution, that such a thing should be done in consultation and with approval of the Diksha Guru, not just sort of, taking shelter of devotee X, even though initiated by devotee Y. One has to be very careful, because there's a very important interaction that takes place. It's natural that just like we only will have maybe a few close friends, that we'll get more inspiration from one or maybe a few individuals than we will from everyone as a group. It's only natural that we want to feel the same kind of inspiration from each and every person. It's equally the same. It's natural. But one has to be very careful, I think, in becoming, in this time and place and age, of thinking that one person has kind of an exclusive slant on what is true and right. We try to take the collective knowledge and get the Siddhanta, just like Prabhupada is quoting Sri Araswami, he's quoting Vishwanath Chakravarti, he's quoting Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he's quoting Jiva Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, and many, many, many others. So even Prabhupada himself, although he had Diksha from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he was, when he wrote his books, he was very profusely quoting from other gurus. And sometimes he would even, find places where they weren't in perfect alignment, that he would say that he would quote both, and we would have to kind of use our intelligence to determine what is the right course. Just like Arjuna had to decide what to do about Aswatthama, he was getting equivocal instructions. Krishna even changed his mind. So it's possible, but when we say Guru Shastra and Sadhu, the very meaning of Sadhu is, in my understanding anyway, it's a plural meaning. It doesn't mean just a particular Sadhu, but it means the whole preceptorial line. And actually when we're getting transcendental knowledge, we are connecting to the whole preceptorial line, the whole disciplic succession. Of course, some of those are not physically with us, but we can also see the body of Vaishnavas. We'll get various opportunities for association with different devotees, and some will take the import of what they say to be more important than others. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, that's just a reflection. It's not an absolute answer. That's some reflections on this. I think we'll have one more. Shashi.
I mean, this, I have still this question, Marshal. So you were mentioning Guru Sadhan Shastra, and we're saying that one should take the permission of Diksha Guru to take shelter of other Diksha Gurus. Now, sometimes if it's, there could be deviations in between, the Diksha Guru may choose to take a total proprietorship on his disciple or whatever, which is probably a deviation in that case, just to give it as an example. And how does one, should one, the first part of the question, should one engage in any discrimination? I mean, if, and to find out if it is a deviation. And if one should engage in discrimination, how should one go about that? And what's the Vaishnava etiquette to go about using discrimination?
I think maybe the best thing is to kind of read about that, because devotees have sat together and they've talked about this, and the concept of very singular proprietorship is mentioned in there as a kind of a deviation, and it's not recommended. But maybe I'll read that and then we can discuss it more in the next class. It's a very good point. So I think we'll end here. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Namo Vishnu Padaya.